Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Mr. Duncan Campbell.
Hey, Dub. Nice to be back again.
First off, can you tell us the years that you were involved in BFM?
It started, with the memory takes me back, around 1979. In fact, before it was BFM, when we were still in decent old AM mono, 91.8. I'd already started writing a bit about reggae for Rip It Up magazine, and through one or two of the other specialist show hosts, I was approached and asked if I'd like to contribute something to the specialist lineup that glorified the Sundays. Just thinking, it was actually, as I say, indirectly through one of the other specialist show hosts, Ken Williams, who used to do a blues show, sort of in tandem with Nigel Horrocks' jazz show. Well, I worked in radio news with both Ken and Nigel, so it was through them that I ended up here. So I started out just doing it once a fortnight, and it kind of took off on its own because it was reggae was very much in the ascendancy in New Zealand. I think Bob Marley's Natty Dread was kind of a watershed for reggae in this country. And of course then he toured here, and that sort of sparked the interest. And when the 12 Tribes of Israel started performing, doing dances with their own live music, there was again a terrific public response, and so the show sort of built from there, carried on through the 80s. There it was.
And from the outset, were you the campus radio sound system?
Yes, that was the name I adopted for fairly early on. I actually borrowed that from an Australian radio show, which was called Rudy's Sound System. A guy based in Melbourne used to do it on one of those donation kind of radio stations that they have over there, and I heard a tape of his show and thought, yes, I'm looking for a look for an identity, and that just seemed the right choice.
Sure. 1979, of course, that was 30 years ago now. I imagine campus radio was a slightly different beast back then.
I think it was often said that BFM back in those days was run by five guys all named Andrew. And they were a terrific crowd. There was a great sense of fun, and of course they didn't have a full time license to start off with, and so every time they got a temporary license for a few weeks at a time, used to be it was a great sense of occasion. I think everyone was tuning in, just enjoying something that was a bit out of the ordinary, because the rest of radio was just so mainstream by then, so commercially driven, and it was just good to hear something a bit quirky, a bit unusual, the sort of music that we were reading about in papers like the NME and so on. It was very much a part of the new music culture that really came alive in this country after punk rock. Sure. Really, in the late 70s and early 80s, and Flying Nun was really in its heyday. The public interest in the new music and the new bands that were starting to form here, I mean, BFM was just such an integral part of all that. I knew that there were one or two people in other parts of the country who were doing it. I know Radio U in Christchurch, they've had somebody, the station associated with Victoria University, Radioactive, had somebody, and I sort of got to know people like Danny Lemon and so on. We started sort of corresponding and swapping the odd tape. And so, of course, everything was done by cassette. We used to keep our shows alive by exchanging music, you know, wherever we could get it, because getting reggae was very, very difficult up until the early 80s, when Roger Douglas and the Longy government finally axed import duty on records. We could finally get so much more music in. When I started out, I had to become a licensed importer in order to get any new music virtually. There were one or two record companies here that were bringing some stuff in. I mean, Festival Records, as it was, had the rights to Island Records, and then RTC had Virgin Frontline. So we were getting some in, but I was still reading about so much material that I just had to import myself, and I used to fight regular battles with the customs department in order to get these records into the country so that I could keep the show going. But also I had a great deal of support from fans who travelled, who brought a few records back themselves, who had a collection of vintage stuff, and they said, hey, you want to borrow this? And I said, fine, excuse me while I put my cassette deck on. And so I ended up assembling an enormous collection of music in that way.
With the stuff you were importing yourself, where were you getting that from primarily?
There was a mail order shop in Sydney called Anthem Records, which was very, very helpful. I was able to get catalogues from them through the mail, and while there was always a bit of a wait because they were importers themselves, the stuff would turn up eventually. And then through the British fanzine Small Axe, I was able to start writing letters, basically, to various companies saying, hey, I'm one guy down here who just plays reggae by himself, and can you send me anything? And quite often I'd suddenly find a package would arrive in the mail. So I developed a relationship first with the Wackies label in New York. They were very good. And then with Ariwa in London, I had a very good relationship with Mad Professor. So I managed, and of course every time I would take an overseas trip, I'd come back with a very heavy suitcase. This track is Up Warwicka Hill by Augustus Pablo. And I chose it as the opening and closing theme for my show, I think in the second year that I was running it. And it just inspired me as one of those tracks that epitomizes reggae. Pablo, I've often referred to him as the Mozart of reggae. He was a genius of a musician, and this track particularly is what I call chamber reggae. You have a small ensemble, every instrument you can hear perfectly. It has an absolute killer of a drum and bass line, and that melodica sound, it haunts me still.
Duncan, as you mentioned before, when you were doing your show in the early 80s, reggae was very much in the ascendancy in this country. From my own point of view, I can say that a great many of the artists that you played on your show, the first time I heard them or any of their music was, in fact, on your show. What sort of feedback did you get from the listeners in terms of what you were providing them each week?
I had a steady stream of regular correspondence, phone callers, fans all over the place. Particularly, I remember I got a lot of letters from guys who were in Mount Eden Prison who were regular listeners to the show, which was very touching. It obviously meant a lot to them to be hearing my music every week. We always had people who were interested, who wanted to know a bit more, where to go, where to find out about things. Of course, before the internet, getting information wasn't that easy. There were a few publications, but very few of them were available here, and your British music papers like the NME, they were several months behind by the time they reached this country, so it was always a playing catch-up. So I was regularly looking for information wherever I could find it, so I could at least tell people a bit about it. But where they could get records, of course, was another matter entirely. As I was saying before, there was very little importing done, and while people like Victor Stent at Festival certainly did their bit to get reggae into the record shops here, it was still very much a minority taste, and so we're always struggling to find ways of getting the music here and getting it out to people.
And you were aware that listeners out there were taping the shows and lending their cassette tapes of the shows to their friends and so on and so on, and taping the tapes that they taped off your show. Yes. On Sundays.
Oh yes, that was quite common, and I didn't begrudge that too much, simply because of the situation that people had no other way of getting the music that they wanted to hear at that time. What I did object to was when I discovered that people were selling tapes of my shows. That I felt was just not on. I always did my bit. I always filled out my APRA sheets and so forth of the music I was playing, in the hope that one day some of money would get back to the artists who made it, because I was perfectly aware that a lot of the artists I was playing didn't make much money, were living in very humble circumstances in Jamaica, and I wanted to try and at least do something on their behalf. When Herbs first came on the scene, and 12 Tribes of Israel, as I mentioned, and then of course down the line, bands like Dreadbeat were starting to establish a Pacific reggae sound that really did acquire a certain local signature that I think has become quite distinctive. If you listen particularly to Dreadbeat's album, All Our Lives, I would say that is reggae from this country. It couldn't have been made anywhere else. It's not like Jamaican reggae, it's not like British reggae. It does have that distinctive South Pacific feel. And I was sort of always out to encourage local people who are trying to make some music.
Heading towards the end of the 80s and so on, more bands doing more recordings.
Well, J-Rim Records, of course, Jim Moss deserves a great deal of credit for the work that he did to get local reggae into the shops. And, of course, I had a long-standing relationship with the 12 Tribes groups, and one of their members, MC Megapower, a good friend of both of us, used to be a regular visitor on the show. He would plug their dances that were coming up, and would always drive people along to those events. Mm-hmm. They got the idea of the way they do it in Jamaica, where you have a regular stream of performers coming and going on stage, and you play all night, They certainly were very, very popular in their heyday.
And you were one of the first non-12 Tribes members to play as a guest for their live shows, I believe.
That was a great privilege, yes, that I've still got some very good friends who are heavily involved with the music body that looked after the band and the DJing that went on there. And yes, I was invited to play at one of their dances, and it was a very special occasion for me. This next song takes me back to Montego Bay, Jamaica, 1986, when I visited Reggae Sunsplash that year. And on the opening night, they had a Studio One orchestra on stage, led by the great Jackie Matu, and a great procession of Studio One artists, amongst them this gentleman. And while I was listening to him, I was at a vendor's stand eating a big plate of curried goat and rice, and the curry goat vendor and myself were singing along with Ken Booth's Moving Away.
When you first started here at BFM in 1979, they were still on AM frequency. Can you remember when it changed to FM?
It was, I think it was 1981 or 82, from memory, that they always had signal problems, of course. They used to have a transmitter sitting up on the roof of the old museum. as getting the signal through, and yet it was amazing how far afield the signal was picked up. That there were listeners all around the Hauraki Gulf. There were listeners down in the Waikato, and up north were able to pick it to pick the show up. It was always interesting to just wonder who was tuning in on any particular night. In the quality of the sound, I mean, as you know, Dub, with reggae, the drum and the bass line is so important. You don't get that on AM. So the switch to FM, people could suddenly get the full impact of reggae. And in particular, I was able to start playing a lot more dub tracks, so that people could appreciate just the studio technique that went into putting together a really fine piece of reggae version. And that made a huge difference to the program, because I started playing sort of version tracks back to back and so forth, and letting the show stretch out a little bit. There's a little game I like to play, a sort of a bit of detective work. As my collection started to build, I would suddenly hear a track and think, now that sounds exactly like something I've got somewhere else. And sure enough, I'd find the matching track, and usually I'd start looking for the common denominator, and it would usually be a producer or an engineer who'd taken a track and remixed it, added a new vocal, whatever, and discovering those ones in places where you were never intended to find them was always a bit of fun
for me. And of course in reggae there's dozens of situations of that kind of thing, where a producer would cut multiple tracks of the same rhythm. You know, you'd have a horns version, you'd have a dub version, you'd have a DJ version, and a couple of singer versions, or even where a producer was unable to pay an artist or a band, so he'd give them a rhythm, and then the artist would go off with that rhythm and then kind of go and cut his own version. And
Lee Scratch Perry perhaps being the absolute master of
the ultimate sort of recycler.
Yes. If reggae has the power to make your hair stand on end and to shiver down your spine, this track, I think, says it all. From the Joe Gibbs Studio, a classic by the great voice of the late Mr. Dennis Brown, Emmanuel.
Thank you.
Duncan, of course, it would have been very gratifying for you over the period that the sound system was running to have seen other BFM DJs slowly kind of warming to the reggae sound and starting to play reggae music as part of their regular daytime shows and so on. And I'm thinking in particular of Adrian Sherwood, and the On You sound label was particularly popular here at BFM. A lot of the DJs got behind that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes indeed. I think On You is responsible for a lot of the crossover of reggae to white audiences. We always say that John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, was, of course, the original mentor for reggae in the UK. But Adrian Sherwood took the sound and gave it that urban feel that really opened it up to rock audiences. And, of course, he was working with reggae artists, members of the Roots Radix, and then with Lee Scratch Perry and others. And so, yes, the On You sound really, again, struck a chord with young white music listeners, because it had that slightly sort of punk new wave edge to it, and they could grasp what was going on there. Fascinating guy, Adrian Sherwood. I do remember meeting him once when I was on a trip to the UK. I'd just written a letter and said I was coming over. I wrote to On You Sound and said, hey, I'd like to come up and say hello. And so I checked into my hotel and I rang them up, and they said, what's your number? We'll call you back. And about half an hour later, the phone rang and said, is that Duncan Campbell? I said, yeah. He said, hi, this is Adrian Sherwood. Ah, right. And so I went out to his house, which is in East Ham. Amazing house, one of those two-storied semi-detached places. And the whole of his front room is converted into a studio. You walk through his front door and you suddenly almost bang into a 16-track mixer. And there's sort of racks of old cassette tapes and so forth all over the place, where he took so many of the fascinating samples that you find on the On You Sound. So that was very, very much a fun occasion. Bits and pieces that he had lying around. He sort of dug into a box and said, "Yeah, try this. This is good. Something we just finished there." So yes, I finished up with a few little treasures.
Like you said, initially when you first started up here, nobody really knew very much about reggae, and you were kind of the strange guy in the corner. And of course, as the years went on, people just really did latch onto it, and it started taking off.
Yes, it was very gratifying as someone who was a regular BFM listener as well to suddenly hear a reggae track and someone actually being enthusiastic about it as well. And I thought, okay, the message is getting through.
It's getting through. Yes. Exactly.
The dub poet has found a voice for reggae that expresses the feelings of anger and sorrow, of oppression, of racism, the struggle to live every day. This track by the master dub poet has a feeling of repressed anger that just boils over towards the end. The tension is just so palpable in this track. This is Linton Kwesi Johnson's Street 66.
Dusk howling softly, 6 o'clock. Charcoal light, the fine sight was moving black. The sound was music, mellow, steady flow. And man's on mind, just mystic red, green, red, green. You're seen. No man would dance but leap and shake. That shocked you feeling right. Shape that sound, tumbling down, making movement rough enough. Cause when the music met eye taps, I felt the sting, knew the shock. Yeah, had to do and ride the rock. Out of this rock shall come a greener rhythm, even more dread than what the breeze of glory bred. Vibrating violence is how we move, rocking with green rhythm, the drought and dry root out. The mighty poet Iroy was on the wire. Western did a skank, and each man laugh. Him feeling iry, dread eye. Street 66, the said man said, any policeman come here will get some righteous rascal licks. Yeah man, holy pa kicks. Hours beat, the scene moving right, when all on a sudden, bam, 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 a knocking upon the door. Who's that? Ox Western, feeling right. Open up, it's the police, come on, open up. What address do you want? Number 66, come on, open up. Western, feeling high, reply. Yes, this is Street 66. Step right in and take some licks.
Campus Radio Sound System became something of an institution here at BFM, and I want to sort of go towards the end of that now, Duncan, and your decision sort of to wind the show up.
After 12 years, I sort of felt I was starting to get a little bit stale with what I was doing, and also, I have to say, I was getting old, that I was basically running the show out of my own pocket and spending a great deal of money to keep the show fresh, to keep new music coming on. And I was finding that so much of the new sound just didn't appeal to me. And when it stops being fun, I think that's when you think, well, maybe I should move on or let someone else have a go who's probably a bit more in tune with this. And I was getting a few calls saying, oh, this is old stuff. Wouldn't you play something a bit more upbeat, you know, play us something, you know, a bit more hip-hop kind of sound. And I thought, well, maybe it is time to give it away. And so I finished up the weekly show, came back in response to a few appeals, and did a show that was concentrating on the older sounds, and I called that Deeper Roots, and I did that as a monthly sort of a magazine kind of a show for a little while. But I knew at that point it was time to be doing other things. Also, as it happened, in 1990 I lost my job, and so the money kind of dried up, and it was becoming a bit of a financial burden to keep the show alive. And then I thought, right, it was time to go out on a high note.
For sure. And of course you didn't stop buying records, but meant that you could no longer buy new music in the volume that you had been used to.
That's true. But what I did was I kept on collecting the things that I loved to listen to and filling in the gaps that I'd never been able to fill beforehand. And it's been great to see so much vintage reggae now re-released and available for everyone to enjoy. We look at the Soul Jazz label. They have brought out Studio One wonderfully remastered. The sound quality is superb. There are various small labels that reissue classic old singles, especially from the Rocksteady era, which was such a small time frame in the history of reggae. Rocksteady barely lasted 2.5 years. But what was produced in that time was absolutely astonishing, and I love that stuff. And it's great to see a lot of those old singles being reissued again. So yes, I'm still collecting. I'm still looking for those rarities to as I say fill the gaps in the collection.
There's vast amounts of reggae that just never saw the light of day back when it was initially released. It was, you know, a handful of copies and so on, and now it's sort of available on CD and easily available and cheaply, and like you said, wonderfully remastered and so on. You know.
And if there's one message we're going to say is keep getting out there and buy.
Of course, reggae did change, and it wasn't an overnight thing, but from 1985 and under Mies Lengteng ushered in the digital era, and slowly over the next few years producers more and more adapted to the digital reggae rhythms, because it was economics. It was cheaper and easier for them to do it themselves with drum machines, keyboards and computers, than it was to hire a full session band. And the sound of reggae most definitely changed. And like yourself, I was very slow to come around to the digital sound. Initially, I didn't like it at all. It sort of left me cold.
Yes, and I have to say too, as you mentioned, the musicians who, you know, just eked out a very very much a subsistence kind of a living with studio sessions. So many of them, the work dried up, and this saw there was an exodus from Jamaica of a great musician who just weren't getting the money, needed an audience. So many of them headed for the States, headed for Britain, for Europe, and Canada, of course, became a bit of an outpost for reggae as well. And that's it to Jamaica's great loss, I think, that the culture there that was so vital and so alive and so distinct in the 60s and the 70s, has so much dried up, and the music, I have to say now, in all honesty, doesn't do a lot for me. The American influence has I think corrupted it in some respects, just the way that cocaine and guns have done it to Jamaican society, which is really tragic.
Something that's heartening to see, I think, is something of a renaissance in Rastafarian music, and also in the roots style, and I see this particularly in Europe. Live instruments coming back into the recordings of music, and certain producers going for a 70s roots vibe, and again, singers, you know, I'm thinking of people like Luciano and so on. It's been very heartening to see that, and I believe this is mainly because of European audiences who love that style of reggae have created a demand. I don't think this has come from Jamaica.
No.
The Jamaican audiences per se, who are quite happy with bashment and ragga. I think it's the Europeans demand this type of music, and this is why you're able to have artists like Burning Spear and Toots and the Maytals who continually tour and
yes.
play in Europe.
And of course, there's an economic factor back with this again too, as far as Jamaica is concerned, because at the time in the 70s even, they didn't have the resources to put on live music. They didn't have the venues, they didn't have the equipment. It wasn't until Reggae Sunsplash was established and brought in the tourists that they were able to see these performers live. In most instances, the only live music they were getting was in the dance halls, and so that the dance hall sound tended to dominate. And I certainly noticed when I was there that the biggest night at Sunsplash was dance hall night, when the crowds came in to see their favourite DJs. This is by one of my all-time favourite artists. I've seen him live 3 times. He's reinvented himself over and over again and always seems to come up sounding fresh, even as he grows older. But he's always sounded a bit like a 1,000-year-old man with that incredible voice of his. And this is a track that, again, if you're going to ask what is reggae, this one says it all for me. There's wonderful, slightly sweet and sour horns and that rhythm that just makes you want to move your feet. This is Tradition by Burning Spear.
In conclusion, Duncan, I'd like to say here we are, the 40th anniversary of BFM. It's been a very long time. I'd like your thoughts on BFM as it is currently, as it stands in the overcrowded Auckland radio market, and the future for the station.
Well, I think BFM carved out its niche very early on, and I think it still occupies there as the feisty brat of radio, that dares to push the boundaries and to try different things, to try new things. It avoids all the cliches that that ordinary commercial radio gets involved in. It is still so heartening to hear a station that cares about the music it plays. It doesn't worry so much about audience demographics and so forth. It knows its identity, it knows its sound, it knows what it wants to deliver. And the people who work, so many of them here still, I believe, work for the love of it, simply because they enjoy music and they enjoy spreading it to other people. And as long as BFM never loses sight of that, because that is how it always was for those of us who were listening to it in the very early days, that as long as it keeps that in mind, I think it'll just go on and will continue to draw a new audience, but also people like me who still enjoy music for its own sake and want to be challenged. I've always said that I would rather be irritated by something than bored to death. And so much radio is just so predictable these days. With BFM, when I turn it on at any given time, I know that I'm bound to hear something I haven't heard before, that I won't hear anywhere else. And it's that really that keeps BFM strong. I could not finish without a track by the man who was there at the beginning and who left us far too soon, Mr. Robert Nesta Marley. I still recall when we heard that he died. It was a dreadfully devastating time for everyone who'd ever known him, who'd loved his music. I still recall when he visited here, and we followed him around basically like faithful puppies just to be near the man. And this song still brings a tear to me every time I hear it. It is one of those deeply touching moments in any music. And I would just like to finish with the greetings to all my friends and all of those who listened to and supported the show over the years. Greetings to the brothers and sisters, 12 tribes of Israel, Selassie, Rastafari. Hold tight. This is Johnny Was. Johnny was a good, good, good.
care, cease to worry.